Good afternoon, comrade. Welcome to our regular Sunday afternoon debating session, hosted by the Consistent Democrats. For the next few weeks, we're going to be studying Lenin's revolution, State and Revolution. Ian is going to be giving a talk on chapter one for about 20 minutes, half an hour,
It
Ian.
might be about half an hour, actually, probably. Yeah.
And then, of course, as usual, I'll open it up for question and answers and general discussion. In the meantime, ideally, it would be ideal comrades who are not speaking should mute their mic in order to avoid interference. And when we get to the discussion, please remember that we are recorded, so try to keep contributions to one at a time. Okay, Ian, take it away.
Okay, right. Well, this is we're studying the State and Revolution, and this is chapter by Lenin, and this is chapter one, which is titled Class Society and the States. So I would say that studying this work is of quite crucial importance for a Marxist tendency. And we're now entering a period of political activity within the party, I think, that offers great promise for the creation once again of a mass working class political movement, a party of the working class. And I think that's what new party, what your party signifies. And we have to understand what the Corbyn Sultana party is about. It's a result of the failure of Labourism in the face of the ruling class's neoliberal offensive against the working class in the advanced capitalist is imperialist countries since the mid-70s. And this has had many different manifestations and timings around the world. But the whole point of the neoliberal project was always that the working class of the advanced countries was too powerful for the well-being of the imperialist bourgeoisie. And what I mean by well-being is in two senses. One is that the bourgeoisie feared the social power of the working class in the advanced countries, and the second being that classic phenomena of capitalist decay, which is the gradually falling rate of profit, had reached a point that the bourgeoisie was desperately looking for some way to increase its profit rates at the expense of the masses. And that was really in the 70s, by the 70s, after 30 years of capitalist boom, post-war capitalist boom. So in the early 70s, in Britain particularly, but also elsewhere, but Britain is a particular example, the ruling class tried frontal industrial confrontation with the labour movement to try to fundamentally weaken the mass organisations of the working class. And so you saw, first of all, Heath's Industrial Relations Act was partly prefigured by the white paper introduced by the Labour government in 1969 called In Place of Strife, which was floated by the Labour government, as I said, the Harold Wilson Labour government in 1969, supported by some people who were then supposed to be on the Labour left, such as Barbara Castle and even Tony Benn at the time. And what this shows actually is that some even thought to be on the left were more attuned to ruling class opinion than the interests of the working class, even then, but in reality, that was a product of reformism's attitude to the state, which Lenin, quoting extensively from Engels, touches upon in this chapter. But I'll come on to that later. At the moment, I'm talking about that situation where the expiring Wilson government of 1969 was hardly suited for a major confrontation with the working class, though such proposals were the logic of a class collaborationist programme. It was the Heath government who tried to confront the trade unions head-on with their Industrial Relations Acts, with compulsory ballots in strikes, attempts to ban solidarity action, and various forms of picketing, and compulsory cooling-off periods in strikes, etc. And the government took on a powerful trade union movement, and basically they lost in the context of a miners' strike in late 1973, early 1974. Heath called a general election in February 1974 on the slogan, "Who rules the country, the government or the unions?" And he lost. The Labour Party ended up with more seats than the Tories in the 1974 election, though the result was very close. And actually, in terms of the popular votes, Heath was actually very slightly ahead, but it's seats that count. And Labour, you know, a sort of an unstable Labour minority government for a few months. And then Labour called another general election in October 74. And this time it improved its performance somewhat more, although it only actually gained an overall majority of 3 seats. But it was during the 1974-79 Labour government that the neoliberal project first, very tentatively, began to be tried out in Britain. Because Labour's majority did not last very long, and before that issue became centre stage, Harold Wilson resigned as Prime Minister and was succeeded by James Callaghan. So from 1976 you had the Lib-Lab Pact, and a series of insidious attacks on the working class through cuts in public spending, including in healthcare, and income policies where the union bureaucracies held back working class discontent in the face of high inflation. And you had such devices as the incentive scheme in the mining industry that was introduced by that Labour government, which laid the basis for divisions among miners that played a major role in dividing the miners later when Thatcher attacked them. So you had a Labour government that was in a semi-coalition with the Labour, with the Liberal Party, that came into conflict with the working class. And that conflict exploded towards the end of its term in the winter of 78-79, with what's called the Winter of Discontent, when all kinds of mainly public sector workers went on strike in a revolt against the government's pay policy, basically, policy of cutting wages through inflation and low pay increases. So Thatcher won his, the 1979 election in May, and she set about full-throated neoliberalism with attacks on strategic sections of the proletariat through mass redundancies. And that was particularly true in steel, in the docks, and in the mines. You know, eventually the mines were the strategic sections that had to be defeated, and duly were. And we had mass privatisation, and the export of jobs to low-wage countries is at the core of the neoliberal project. And the aim was always to seriously weaken the organised working class, and not on a temporary basis, as it was done in the 20s, in the 1926 general strike, when it was pay cuts for miners that provoked a general strike, which the union bureaucracy betrayed, and laid the basis for what was effectively the reign of terror in industry for several years. You know, this was actually a more serious project of weakening the power of the working class through removing whole strategic sections from the advanced countries. And since the days of Thatcher and the 10-year implementation, the decades-long implementation of this reactionary revolution in Britain, and something similar happened in the United States with what they call the Reagan Revolution, where similar attacks took place. Since those days, neoliberalism became hegemonic in the imperialist world, and that went in hand with the imperialist offensive that Thatcher and Reagan sort of pursued internationally, above all through confrontation with the degenerating, with the degenerated workers' state of the USSR in the 1980s, which eventually brought the USSR to its knees. And it brought about the pro-capitalist liberalisation of the Stalinist regime under Gorbachev, and then the seizure of power by an outright counter-revolutionary leader, Boris Yeltsin, who also sprang from the bureaucracy, and he was originally the chief of the Moscow Communist Party. So, I mean, those days were almost like a different world to what we live in today, you know. But since those days, the social democracy and the old bourgeois liberalism exposed their bankruptcy by becoming thoroughly neoliberal. And the British Labour Party is thoroughly neoliberal in a period where the bosses, driven by the imperative to raise their rate of profit, declare war on every gain of the working class and seek to abolish it by privatisation, outsourcing and the rest. In those circumstances, reformism doesn't really work. In fact, it doesn't work at all. So we've had social neoliberalism instead of reformist social democracy for many, for decades now, you know, going back to the Wilson-Callaghan government. Arguably, even at its prehistory with in place of strife, you could argue that, you know. But of course, the working class does not take kindly to being shafted. And we've had left movements within the Labour Party through all that period. We had the paler one being Bennism, of course, you know, in the 80s. We've had elements of fragments of Labour to resist this neoliberal offensive politically, sometimes with aid of parts of the far left. So in after Blair abolished Clause 4 in the mid-90s, we had the SLP, the Socialist Labour Party of Arthur Scargill, in 1996. It was really a viable, a vibrant project for a little while, for a couple of years, until about 1998. And then you had Respect, after the, you know, in the period of the Iraq War, sort of lasted for most of the decade of the 2000s, actually, until it petered out. And you've had other smaller projects like the Socialist Alliance and Left Unity. But the big one, of course, was Corbyn in 2015 onwards. And that's when popular anger at neoliberalism briefly took control of the Labour Party itself through a massive influx of new members and also many former members. And the neoliberal right in the Labour Party, imbued with Zionist politics, weaponised anti-Semitism scares, and also right-wing nationalism over Brexit, and manoeuvred and used those things furiously to defeat Corbyn's leadership and drive this massive left-wing constituency out of the Labour Party. But I would argue they won a Pyrrhic victory. They got rid of the left, drove them into exile, and even managed to create the most openly reactionary, bordering on far-right, Labour government in history. And that government is a real recruiting sergeant for the real far-right, you know. But the mass base of the Corbyn-led revolt against neoliberalism went into exile, a sort of exile, and just bided its time until the opportunity emerged to create a new party, which now is taking shape, albeit slowly. Your party was created, in a sense, by the bold initiative of Zara Sultana in July in resigning from Labour and pushing Corbyn to get a move on, really, in creating this new party. But the problem is that the revolt against the neoliberalism of Labour is being waged under the banner of left-wing social democracy. But the cause of the crisis that gave birth to this is the bankruptcy of social democracy in the face of neoliberalism. And I think that's a fertile contradiction for communists to engage with. And that's a good reason why communists should join the new party and encourage both our comrades and the militants of your party to study Lenin and other such Marxist material. So, I mean, that's just a preface to the whole reason as to why we're studying this, really. I'll move on to the actual chapter. And, you know, it's quite a brief chapter in some ways. It's an introductory chapter. So I'll just go into what are its central points. Because State and Revolution was written for a socialist movement that was in flux after the betrayal of all the anti-war and socialist promises of the social democratic parties, including the British Labour Party, the French, and the most developed politically of them was the German Party, the SPD. They all collapsed into chauvinism in the First World War. And the whole point of this work is to delve into how social democracy, particularly in Germany, where it was most sophisticated, had mangled the approach of Marxism to questions involving the state, and how to correct those problems. It was written in 1917, in the face of the developing workers' revolution in Russia. And though we're not in a developing revolution, many of the issues dealt with are not that different from the problems that we face the militants in your party and ourselves. And we need programmatic answers on the question of the state, which is central. So, Lenin asks the question, what is the state? And he draws upon Engels in such works as Anti-Düring, and also his famous work, The Origin of the Family, Private Property and the State, to give some answers to that. And from this, you get the concept is made pretty clear that the state is an expression of the fact that society has split into irreconcilably warring classes. It's a weapon of the economically dominant class to keep in check the struggles of the subordinate oppressed classes and prevent society from being overwhelmed by the struggle between those classes. So the state then is a weapon of the economically dominant, that is the ruling class, in any given society. And Engels gives a sort of a rundown of succeeding societies when he says, and I think this is from Anti-Düring, he says, the ancient and feudal states were organs for the exploitation of the slaves and serfs. Likewise, the modern representative state is an instrument of exploitation of wage labour by capital. By way of exception, however, periods occur in which the warring classes balance each other so nearly that the state map power as a sensible mediator acquires, for the moment, a certain degree of independence of both. Such were the absolute monarchies of the 17th and 18th century, the Bonapartism of the First and Second Empires in France, and the Bismarck regime in Germany. So, under primitive communism, before human society split into contending classes, there was no special armed repressive organisation separate from the population. Only the population itself as what he calls a self-acting armed organisation, that's Engels by the way, that was able to defend itself collectively as and when the need arose. So the state is a special armed organisation, separate from society and closed off from the mass of the population. And Lenin quotes Engels as saying this. He says, the distinguishing feature is the establishment of a public power which no longer directly coincides with the population organising itself as an armed force. This special public power is necessary because a self-acting armed organisation of the population has become impossible since the split into classes. This public power exists in every state. It consists not merely of armed men, but also material adjuncts, prisons, and instruments of coercion of all kinds, which Gentile, that is, clan society, knew nothing. And he continues to concretise this as the state arose from the split of society into irreconcilable classes. So, as such class rule will become obsolete, which is what we're fighting to happen, he says this. He says, the state, then, has not existed from all eternity. There have been societies that did without it, that had no idea of the state and state power. At a certain stage of economic development, which was necessarily bound up with the split of society into classes, the state became a necessity owing to this split. We are now rapidly approaching the stage in the development of production at which the existence of these classes will not only have ceased to be a necessity, but will become a positive hindrance to production. They will fall as they arose at an earlier stage. Along with them, the state will inevitably fall. Society, which will reorganise production on the basis of a free and equal association of the production of the producers, will put the whole machinery of state where it will then belong, into a museum of antiquities, by the side of the spinning wheel and the bronze axe. So then Lenin goes on to talk about this question, about the withering away of the state, and the necessity for a violent revolution to overthrow the rule of the possessing classes, i.e. of the bourgeoisie, the capitalist class. And he says this. He says, society thus far operating amid class antagonisms needed the state, that is, an organisation of the particular exploiting class, for the maintenance of its external conditions of production, and therefore, especially, for the purpose of forcibly keeping the exploited class in the conditions of oppression determined by the given mode of production, i.e. slavery, serfdom or bondage, wage labour, etc. And he goes on, he says, when at last it becomes the real representative of the whole of society, it renders itself unnecessary. As soon as there is no longer any social class to be held in subjection, as soon as class rule and the individual struggle for existence based on the present anarchy in production, with the collisions and excesses arising from this struggle, are removed, nothing more remains to be held in subjection, nothing necessitating a special coercive force, a state. The first act by which the state really comes forward as the representative of the whole of society, that is through the taking of possession of the means of production in the name of society, is also its last independent act as a state. State interference in social relations becomes, in one domain after another, superfluous, and then dies down of itself. The government of persons is replaced by the administration of things, and by the conduct of processes of production. The state is not abolished, it withers away. And that is from anti-During again. And the crucial point about this is the question of the withering away of the state. Lenin is quoting this for a highly specific purpose, to combat the distortion of this concept by reformists and centrists such as Kautsky in the camp of German social democracy. And the crucial point that the reformers had long mystified and elided elided this question and avoided it with their activities in the existing state. They propagated the idea that, superintended by reformists like themselves, the repressive forms of the bourgeois state would just wither away. You know. But that's not what Engels or Marx, for that matter, are actually projecting at all. It's the opposite. Because for these revolutionary leaders, the precondition for the state, which would be a workers' state, to wither away, was the prior violent overthrow and destruction, disbanding and dispersal of the existing capitalist state, of its special bodies of armed men, its prisons, etc. And only after a revolutionary overturn could such a new state be created, a state where, instead of the mass of the exploited and oppressed population being kept forcibly in their place by the state of their class enemies, you would have the exploiting minority losing their power and being kept in their place, that is, being suppressed by the population armed and organised against them. And that is the work of state, which should only then be in a position to wither away, as Engels had put it. So that polemic was really directed not just against anarchists who thought they could simply abolish the state straight away, but more so against the reformists who believed that under their rule, under their supervision or superintendence, the existing bourgeois state could somehow wither away without a violent social revolution, without a social overturn of the existing order. I mean, that basically concludes the messages, the basic polemic in the first chapter, I think. We'll continue to study this as we go through the book, but that really is a bit of a grounding in what the book is about, and hopefully I'll put it into a context that makes it explicable why we're studying it. Thank you, comrades.
Okay, comrades, thank you. As I said before, remember that we are being recorded, so please try to keep your contributions still one at a time, and obviously where possible to indicate with your vocal hand. Mm-hmm. Are there any questions or contributions based on what we've read?
Mark. Oh, sorry, you said.
Mark A.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. I think I'm unmuted. Yeah. Yeah, as well as... I'm just trying to think what the parallels to today are in terms of a new socialist party starting up. It's a difficult one because, of course, with social media, you want to appeal to as many people as possible, but you're also hidebound by the bigotry of everybody else, mm-hmm. Which, of course, they didn't have 108 years ago, where you could work in secret in preparing a party with a polemic, with an ideological slant, if you like. You knew who the enemies were, more obviously. Mm-hmm. But today it's a lot tougher, and I'm just trying to work out what Lenin might actually see in social media that would be a negative in this situation. And how that could be avoided, or how the spillover to liberals and fascists, being more obvious entryists, shall we say, how that kind of spillover could be avoided. Thank you.
Sure. Ian, do you want to answer any of that?
Well, I might come back in a minute, but just see if anybody else wants to speak. Susan, sorry, Paul's chairing.
You okay, Paul, for me to go ahead?
Yeah, go ahead.
How would they deal with the ideological intransigence of things like Zionism, whether it's Christian or other, and the... shall we say, the rise of the intransigence of, in America, if you like, the complete denial of anything that is not capitalist. Mm-hmm. It's as if all of the things like human nature being interpreted as it can only be competitive, or that, you know, that cooperation, that commensalism, people working together, religious tolerance, the identity politics that is fractured and is misused, shall we say. It's not just the organs of the state, it's the weaponization of words that have that are necessarily suppressing debate and people exploring these ideas. Because it feels like you listen to the publications of the 18th and 19th century, there was far more discussion and debate and ideas than there is now on the concepts of how society would work together if they didn't need to work 24/7, that they didn't have to live lives where they are marginalized, that we are in denial of the threats to employment, the apartheid, the misogyny, you know, the whole system has become, for want of a better word, atomized. It's been broken down into certain things that people can think about. Yes? And we've been almost coerced into not thinking about things. Yeah?
Ian?
I'll come back, actually, yeah. I mean, just in response to Mark first, you know. Well, I think social media is obviously a new development, isn't it? You know, it's new. It's not just new for the period of neoliberalism, because it wasn't around until the mid-90s at the very earliest, you know, in reality. And it's something that's evolved very recently into what it is, which is a mighty means of communication and debate. But at the same time, you end up with debate with all comers, and you know, the old barriers between that we could put up against various opponents have been sort of made impractical. Really, you end up fighting and against all kinds of different trends. You know. Whether that's a good thing or a bad thing is somewhat irrelevant, because we have to deal with it, you know. And I think the basic polemical points, we have to deal with social democracy. We have to deal with the fact that social democracy has created this situation by its failings, where we have a workers' movement that's somewhat disoriented, but is looking for a new way forward. And, well, you know, I mean, we have to sharpen up our ideas up and find ways of fighting against those various trends. You know, we're interacting. You know, I think that the whole Your Party milieu will change things again, assuming the party does show that, you know, does become a real mass force. It will change things again. It will open up the field for discussions on, with all kinds of different left-wing trends on the strategy to go forward. So I think that's a positive thing. And it won't be just on social media, of course. It'll be in real sort of meetings and either hybrid or physical in many cases. It will be on demonstrations and such like, you know, with leaflets, with oratory, you name it. You know, there are all sorts of different possibilities of what might happen, and what we will have to use, what techniques we will have to use when it becomes possible to do so. So I don't think I don't think things have changed that much. I think different means of communication, different means of, I mean, in the old days, it was basically physical printed leaflets or, you know, impromptu street meetings, you name it, strike meetings, all sorts of stuff. You know, those were the techniques of the days of the early communist movement. They had to do it all themselves physically, you know. Now it's done in slightly in a different way, with different means of communication. But that doesn't really change the programmatic messages that we're trying to get across, I don't think, you know. It just changes the techniques we have to try and to actually do that, you know. In terms of how do these points interact with things like, I'm trying to think what Susan was saying, to do with, you know.
I'm talking about the religious, the fanaticism with which certain things are, certain ideas are verboten. Yeah, that certain ideas are literally can put you in jail, can lose your job. You know, the heresies, if you like, that are stifling debate. Yeah.
Well, that's always been true, though, isn't it? That's the thing. I mean, even in the 20s and 30s, you're likely to be slung. If you put out a leaflet that denounced such and such a powerful personage or whatever, they're likely to stick you in jail, you know, or maybe even shoot you in some circumstances. You know, there were witch hunts in the 20s, you know, against communists, even after the Russian Revolution in the United States. There was the Palmer raids against migrants in the US who were suspected of having communist sympathies, and that was around 1919, you know, and never mind the whole history of subsequent witch hunts and McCarthyism and you name it, you know, all these things went on then. It's just the technology was different, you know. So I don't think it's, I don't, you know, I mean, there's all sorts of taboos. I mean, we talk about things like gay rights and the questions of identity politics as well, and trans rights and all sorts of different Jewish identity politics. All these things existed then. It's just they weren't on social media. You know, you had to deal with all these questions in different ways. And in some ways, those societies were more backward because some of these questions were completely submerged. I mean, in the Russian Revolution, the Russian Bolsheviks were the first people in the world, as far as I'm aware, as a state, to declare complete equality of heterosexual and homosexual relationships. And that was only in European Russia. They couldn't do it elsewhere, you know. Because they hadn't got the authority to do so, the political authority. They were still trying to conquer that authority in some of the other non-Russian republics, you know. So, you know.
Didn't they also have equal pay and equal education?
I'm sure they did, yes. And so do we, formally, in many places. You know, it's under attack. But it's not been abolished, has it? You know, at least
we have equal pay, but we don't have. But women don't have equal pensions at the end of their working life.
No, hold on, can we please try and avoid cutting across each other? Mm.
To a degree. I mean, I'm trying to remember what Susan was saying, and it's quite complicated. So if she reminds me, I'm not going to say, you know, that, whatever. You know, but yeah, I mean, all these questions are in dispute, and they're probably in dispute then in different contexts. You know, I mean, there was no equal, you know, until the late 20s, there was no equal women's suffrage in this country, was there? There was all sorts of things. There was no basic universal suffrage until 1918, you know. There was no real women's suffrage until 1929. There was all sorts of disputes about questions involving oppression and denials of democratic rights that really hasn't changed. It's changed, obviously the specifics have changed, but the fact that we have to wage battles about all these things, it's just happening in a different context. And there were far-right movements then that were attacking people, you know, attacking rights. And, of course, it culminated with what happened in the 1930s, which was in many ways worse than what we have now, you know. But all these questions had to be dealt with then, and they have to be dealt with now. We have social media now, which provides a different way of fighting some of these things out. Whereas previously the technological basis would have been paper and Ronio or whatever, and, you know, printed leaflets, you name it, you know, speaking in large meetings without a microphone or with very crude means of amplification, things like that, you know. So many differences, but so many, you know, what I say is that what's the French expression? Plus ça change, plus la même chose. That the more things change, the more they stay the same. That you still have to fight the same battles, you just don't do it in the same way because the technology has changed. And I do think this stuff is relevant because we have an argument that the whole of that the reason why the Labour Party is what it is today is because social democracy didn't work and it folded into neoliberalism, and now we're trying to resist it. But the initial ideological banner of the new party is a left wing form of social democracy, and we have it will either recapitulate the original problems of social democracy, and we've seen attempts to do that that have done just that. I mean, think of Syriza and what happened to Syriza. It was sort of a leftist form of Eurocommunism that played a role in, well, after PASOK had decisively betrayed the working class in Greece, you had Syriza. Oh, great, a new left-wing party. That had a sort of flawed origin in left-wing Eurocommunism. But it became a new party of the left. And what did it do? It betrayed the working class just as much as its predecessor did, because it never escaped from reformism, you know, and it had its own political problems as well, you know, and this is what we've got to deal with. Well, we've got a hard argument that we've got to escape from left-wing social democracy. We've got to go beyond it. We've got to embrace revolutionary positions. But we can't just give that as an ultimatum. We have to explain it and educate people and win them over. You know, and I think there's actually a lot of it about, there's a lot of people who are potentially sympathetic. Well, that is true as well. You know, it's control. There will be censorship. There'll be all sorts of things. You know, it's the same political battles. That's the point I'm making, in a different context. And yes, there is censorship on social media. We know this. There's different forms of social media, of course. There's not just Facebook. There's all sorts of things. You know, we're going to have to make use of all sorts of stuff. You know. And we're going to have to make use of conventional leaflets and speeches as well, you know. But, yeah, hopefully that answers some of it anyway.
Mark A.
Yeah, I mean, what you were saying earlier, Ian, about the class battles, this is where I find that the historical documentation most interesting and most relevant. They act as a warning over how the class battles themselves never change,
mm-hmm.
and how capitulation to liberalism is all too easy. Constantly be mindful of that.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Sure. Paul.
I just wanted to come back on similar to Mark's point, actually, that... Except when you said about some of the battles were around then that we're still battling with now, or at least they come back to the fore again, sort of thing. I'm always reminded, I know Tony Benn was Labour, but I'm always reminded of that famous Tony Benn quote that... Every generation has to fight the same battles. There's no final victory and there's no final defeat. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to remember that, because it does seem that the only thing that changes is the technology, but the antagonisms of whether people have got enough to live on and that sort of thing, and the reversal of nationalisation to privatisation and vice versa. Those battles are always ongoing, aren't they? And when there's an economic downturn, it then spills over into social issues, and that's when people look for scapegoats. Whether it's immigrants, gay people, etc., etc.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, I just wanted to make that point. That was all. Thanks.
Sure.
Anyone else want to come in? Mark C. or Diana, do you want to say anything?
Well, let me just make one point about Tony Benn. Because he's remarked that everybody has to go through the same process. I think it's partly true that we all have to fight the same battles over and over again, and you never win and you never definitively lose either. You know, it's a repeating process. I think there's some truth in that. But I also think it's a bit of a self-fulfilling prophecy with left-wing social democracy. There is an old saying about British trade union... British trade unionists, many British trade union militants believed in fighting the class struggle but never actually in winning it. You know, they'd fight all these battles and they would try to elect, you know, the government they want and everything, but they would never go ahead to it always limited itself through social democracy to exactly the limit that we're talking about here. That it never goes beyond, patching up or working with the existing state. And therefore the existing state and the existing ruling class control of that state, because that is the whole point of the state, is the state is an instrument of the ruling class to control the oppressed and exploited class in the end, and to make sure the class struggle doesn't get out of hand. You know, if you don't win it, if you don't actually take power, state power, if the working class refrains from taking state power, it will be condemned over and over again to re-waging the same defensive and offensive battles. And of course the problem is that capitalism will not allow us indefinitely to continue to do that, because eventually it will destroy civilization, as Marx and Engels pointed out, that the alternative is not eternal capitalism or eternal class struggle. It's that it's basically that class society will destroy itself, and you'll end up with barbarism if you don't get socialism. You know, it's put rather sharply by Rosa Luxemburg, and it's being said today because we can see it. You know, you can see it with climate change, you can see it with nuclear threat of nuclear war, and all these things. It will not go on forever, and we won't have the struggles. The same struggles are indefinitely. We have to win this, otherwise we're basically doomed in the long term. Not necessarily now. We're not catastrophists who say that everything's going to collapse today or we're all going to die, because that might not be true. But nevertheless, that is the historical perspective. Anyway, I'll let Paul do
Mark C. and then Susan. Go on, Mark.
Yeah, I was just... It feels like there's an invincible ignorance at the moment. The people on social media are all saying exactly the same thing. It's almost as if even the stupid people are trained. The Zionists are absolutely brilliant at just storming through everyone without anybody beating them whatsoever in any sort of discussion. And this country refuses to move from where it is. It just carries on doing the same old thing, and it feels impossible to change. And sometimes I wonder why I'm marching on with the fight, because it does feel impossible to change. And I think, social media has had a lot to do with it, but it was never as bad as this in the first place. And it's become, it's almost become a lethal weapon now. And I can't see how we're going to change it. And I can't see how we're going to change people's minds, because you've got the media and the Westminster parties constantly doing the same thing. Politicians constantly coming on and talking garbage and not answering questions. And you've got the media constantly pumping out lies. So it's pretty well, it looks like an impossible fight. And I'll be looking for answers for a long time. I don't know. Okay, anyway, that's all I wanted to say.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Mark. Do you want to take that point before I bring in Susan?
Well, yeah, but I don't know. I mean, I think we have to find ways of getting around the various limitations of social media. In the past, we had... we had just had legacy media. At least with social media, with the various different strands of it, you can put forward alternative views. Whereas in the old legacy media, you could it's very it was very difficult to get anything in the media at all. Now you can create your own portals and various sites and things, and you can actually address a mass audience. There are people who do. George Galloway, for instance, he has millions of people watching his show. So does Owen Jones, And there are a bunch of other people who have very large audiences who are able to influence those people. I mean, maybe we need to change our tactics a bit and do stuff like that, to use YouTube more or whatever. I mean, I've got several thousand Facebook friends, but then again, Facebook is very censorious, and you get problems. But there are people who've got Telegram channels that have got tens of thousands of, or maybe even hundreds of thousands of followers. Things like this, there are other ways of doing things. Maybe we need to think of other ways. Just a thought, anyway.
Even NMA.
And I was going to say, quite frankly.
Go ahead, Susan.
Yeah, quite frankly, the West, the empire of lies, if you want, whether you see it as, a US empire, an Anglo-American empire, or, run by Zionists or whatever, but at the end of the day, this is a barbaric empire. It is not civilized. There is nothing civilized about, a president announcing that they are going to regime change an elected president, whether it's of a big country or a small one. There is nothing civilized about a president of a country announcing proudly that he has assassinated, decapitated another state. There is nothing civilized about people being bombed or people being killed and then them being welcomed. There is nothing civilized about handing out Nobel Peace Prizes to somebody who is asking for their country to be overrun because she is far too unpopular to ever be elected. We are not civilized, and people are being imprisoned for pointing that out. I think we've got to actually say, what is civilized? And it's just, the masses, the people are being, I keep saying about bread and circuses, but the truth is, I don't think whether it's the footy or whether it's, endless Netflix or Disney World or whatever the crap is that people are being fed, as once there is no more bread, there will be barbarism on a scale that the globalists can no longer handle. And they think they're going to get away with World War III. And we have to fight that. Yeah? So I think we've got to push this. This is not civilization. This Americanization of this complicity in barbarism. By saying, the IDF is the most moral army in the world. It only shoots, one bullet for, a pregnant mother or whatever. It is disgusting in its bloodiness, starving people to death. And it's not, I call him kid starver because children go to school hungry. It's not all far away. It's just out of sight. And people not talking about it. So I'm not saying that, but I it felt like a lot of the what you're talking about, you are talking about civilization. I think the problem is that we've lost the moral compass has been knocked away by capitalism in it, and we are being exposed to the real price we pay for what is in effect a continual imperialist enterprise.
Do you want to answer that before I bring them up?
I'll come back in a bit.
Okay, Mark, hey, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I would argue, Mark, that Zionism is discrediting itself on a daily basis. Yeah, it doesn't win any arguments. It puts them, of course, it's got a compliant media to mainstream media, so-called, to basically support it and report it selectively. But they are so bizarrely wrong on every level. I'm sure they know it, but they're so entitled they can get away with that. But to such an extent that there is a generation growing up who aren't buying it across the world, not just in the US. It's good to see that it includes the US as well. That it will collapse internally. Zionism as an ideology, it'll become just a little rump of a death cult and nothing else. That's my view. Thanks.
Diana.
Yeah, I would agree with what Mark just said. I would question whether what we call civilization has ever been civilized, because hasn't it always been built on a group of people taking a small group of people taking a big share and ruling the other people, like with early kings, feudalism, and then capitalism. And I would also not blame, put all the blame on the US for being so uncivilized. Where did they get it from? Who conquered North America? Mm. Yeah, it was England, wasn't it? And then Britain. That's the US is the spawn of the devil, and the devil is us. It's Britain.
Yeah, I mean, I personally would agree with a lot of that. I mean, with regards to Britain, Lenin in the chapter itself does actually refer to Britain in France before he actually creates the blame with the US. So, of course, it's a product of when that text was written. So, yes, you're right about Britain's role in it. We talk about the US as it is today, but it's at the time when Lenin published the State of Revolution, he was largely talking about, I think it was mainly Britain and Germany, wasn't it? He was referencing. Ian, do you want to come back?
Well, yeah, I'll come back on a couple of things. One is this question of civilizations. I think we're in a more interesting period in some ways, because what's happened and what is happening is that the veil of civilization is being torn away from the West. And there's been part of social democracy was the belief that the West was some way civilized. And that's what the basis for the class compromise always was. That social democracy always believed that Western imperialism had some aspect of it that could be made to act in the interests of the working class, that there was something latently reformable and progressive about the countries of the West. Now, that is being torn away. That is being demonstrated to millions of people that it's not true. And it's being exposed. The Gaza genocide is one example. But there are other things, you know. The rise of right-wing populism or of semi-fascism in many countries, in many of the so-called civilized countries, is producing a counter-radicalization. And you see that. You see one example of that in New York, you know, with the rise of Mamdani as a response to Trumpism, you know. There will be, I mean, that's still finding its expression through a very fringe element of the Democratic Party. But it could find expression in other ways. And it's, you know, things like your party could actually give it a much more radical expression, because it's not the Democratic Party. It's something that's got no attachment whatsoever organically to the ruling class. So it could actually produce something very radical indeed. And that's why we really should be involved, and we should be quite, you know, we should be as open as we possibly can about what we're advocating. And we need to sharpen up our tools, our polemical tools, to make this to help to be the yeast that radicalizes those people, that enhances, that educates, that gives them a higher political consciousness, so that these things can develop in that direction, upwards, away from the from social democracy and conventional reformist politics, you know. So yes, I think, I mean, Susan is right to talk about how the West is not civilized, but you know, we give it, it's a very stressful period. You know, things are happening that my God, they are really quite hairy. But on the other hand, it's exposing to millions just how bad how barbaric, latently, the Western imperialist countries really are, you know. And I think that's a source of optimism, because we will get more radical, we will get movements that will go way to the left of what we're used to. I think that's quite likely, and a symptom of that is New York, you know. And that's probably a very pale symptom of it, you know, in my opinion, because what will happen in other places where there is, see, in the United States, there is no tradition of independent working class political organisation, which is why this thing has refracted through the Democrats. But in Europe there is, right? In Britain there is, you know, in all the continental European countries there are mass parties of the working class, and some of them have been up and down. There have been new parties that have risen and fallen. But in different contexts. But I think in this context, there is real grounds to believe you could produce something that's much more amenable to revolutionary politics with the right tactics. And the tactics are behaving as it, you know, if you read the Communist Manifesto, it spells out how communists behave towards the working class movement. We're not a separate sect. We are part of the movement, albeit we are the most conscious part of the movement. And we, you know, we point the way forward. We put the interests of the movement as a whole, the interests of the working class movement as a whole. We're not a sealed off sect. We are organically part of it. That's what we want to be here, you know. But I think there's grounds for optimism.
Anyone else want to come in?
Well, I was going to say, Ian, this country has a monarchy.
Yep.
And does, you know, we have a, if you like, a lumpen proletariat who seem not to want to get rid of the monarchy, no matter how inbred and incestuous and just generally perverse they actually are. It's like, it's, I don't understand why it is part of supposedly our identity when it is so often reviled for the privilege and the resentment that it gets. But where are we? But when you actually talk about a republican system or a republic, you know, as Britain as a republic or as a regional representation, it feels like there is no appetite for people to change the system. And yet I can't see how a working class and equality can ever be achieved as long as the monarchy remains. So I'd just like to know how many people here can see a way forward for socialism if it continues to hang on to these, you know, the outmoded class system that we are still saddled with. Yeah, you know, you were talking about how you know, anarchists that neither Marxism nor Lenin can really see the place for anarchism. But I can't see without overthrowing the monarchy and the class system that is now, this country is ever going to get out from under that feudal mentality. Can you?
Diana.
Oh, yeah, Diana, come here first.
Well, that's a good point about the just the existence of that sodding monarchy inculcates a feudal mentality in the population, and it's such nonsense. But I don't know. I mean, there is a lot of stupid acceptance of it, but I don't know how much lack of opposition to it is not so much lack of opposition, but it's overwhelmingly powerful, and their power and their wealth and the extent to which they're actually leeching off us financially, materially, is hidden. People just don't know. And I've only been finding out just how bad it is recently, and certainly since I was a teenager, I was appalled by the existence of those bums, but I didn't know just how bad they are. Yeah, I mean the one bit of light in all that is the Andrew effort, who's doing his best to expose to us what that system is, but it just feels so overwhelming to get rid of it.
Ian,
I'll come back on that. Basically, if you read Marx and Engels, they call for the abolition of the monarchy then, you know, in Britain, you know. It's not been in the programme of the Labour Party. It should be in the programme of your party. Actually, Zara Sultana has spoken up about this, which is good. And it should be part of the policy of the party. We should move a motion on this if we can. I'm not sure we'll be able to in this situation, but there's going to be policy conferences coming up. This founding conference is a little bit different, but yes, we need to get policy motions through branches, get various policies on the agenda, including the monarchy, the abolition of the monarchy as party policy. The Labour Party has never had the abolition of the monarchy as its policy, and that is a huge dereliction from the British Labour Party. But then the British Labour Party never claimed to be Marxist, unlike the German social democracy, which in the early years of the 20th century and at the end of the 19th century claimed to be Marxist in some sense. Right. But the British social democracy has never claimed to be Marxist and has always been monarchist. And if you read Trotsky's Where Is Britain Going, he pulverises the various factions around, including people like Ramsay MacDonald and I'm trying to think who else, you know, Henderson and all that lot, who were the pioneering generation of British labourism. Well, not quite, because it was Keir Harvey, but he didn't, you know, he didn't survive that long. But the main generation of Labour leaders who became the central to the first Labour government in 1924, they were all bloody monarchists. You know, and that's a huge failing. That is the conservative nature of the British Labour Party, and that's what we're trying to break away from. So in that sense, I mean, for instance, Steve Freeman, his bee in his bonnet is the monarchy. But he's not wrong about that. What he's wrong about, but he is the is a two-stage revolution schema where you get rid of the monarchy under capitalism and then you have socialism. But I think it's a bit like permanent revolution. You have to do both at the same time, you know. The abolition of the monarchy is a key point of our programme, or it should be a key point of our programme and the programme of the new party. And I think we do have to push for that, yeah. Yeah, it's absolutely essential. It's one of the great failings of British labourism that it's never been and Republican Party, even in formal terms, ever, as far as I'm aware. When was there ever a Labour leader? Even Corbyn didn't really make a fight about this. I know what he privately believes, but it was done. It's the same as all the other things, you know, the various compromises he made, you know, including staying in NATO and all this sort of thing. We want a party that's anti-NATO, anti-Zionist, anti-monarchist, you know. We do need to push all that stuff, and it needs to be made very, very clear. Actually, Corbyn today, apparently yesterday in Putney, he did make a more sort of clearly anti-Zionist speech. He's obviously been pushed and argued with, and I mean, we need to push on all these things, don't we? Yeah, sorry, I'll leave it there.
I was going to come in on some of that point, actually, about republicanism, because I think the only main campaigning organisation in the UK at the moment that campaigns for Republic is called Republic, isn't it? And I believe it's ostensibly a bourgeoisie organisation. Beyond actually abolishing the monarchy, it doesn't have a programme beyond that. And as you say, and I think we need more than that. And that's my problem. As you say, with Steve Freeman, he criticised communists for not talking about republicanism, but communists don't need to talk about republicanism, because in my view, it's a given that if you're a communist, you're naturally a republican.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's all going to be part and parcel of your programme. So yes, there is republic, but as I say, it's a bourgeoisie organisation. I just want to make that point. Thanks. Anyone else want to come in?
Well, let me make one point about that. You're right that a communist by nature should be a republican and would be a republican. But nevertheless, you do have to make it explicit. And, you know, the strong side of Steve Freeman is he always makes it explicit. The weak side is that he makes it a bourgeois programme. You know, he doesn't put it in the context of the actual socialist revolution. He says if you do that, it's a cop-out. But I don't think that's really true. I think you have to, as I said, it's like permanent revolution. Permanent revolution, not quite the same thing, but there is an unfinished element of the democratic revolution in Britain. But unfortunately, it's so long unfinished that you can't actually make it into a bourgeois revolutionary programme, because that's fucking out of date and by a couple of centuries, you know. You need to have a programme of socialist revolution that includes the abolition of the monarchy as a key it's a democratic demand. It's not a socialist demand, but it needs to be put in the context that we have to implement that democratic demand as a precondition for the rest of the programme. Because if you try to implement socialism and keep the monarchy, well, that's a fucking contradiction in terms, isn't it? You know, and you end up slipping back into Labourism. You know, so you've got to do both simultaneously. You don't want a capitalism without a monarchy. You end up with the United States or France. We don't want that. We want socialism without a monarchy, but the idea of a socialist monarchy is ridiculous. So you've got to do it all at the same time. They've got to be interlinked. Otherwise, you end up falling in through one hole or the other. You know. Anyway.
Mark C and then Diana.
I think, have I got the microphone on?
You have, yeah.
Yeah, you have.
I think, take your party for an example. People are already looking for... You can kind of forget the Green Party because they're teetering on neoliberalism again anyway. But your party, the problem is... One of the problems with your party is I noticed that there were too many... There's too many big guns like John Williams and my friend Kevin Overton who ripped into me because I made a comment on one of the... one of the updates or whatever it was, and I made the wrong comment. It was meant for somewhere else, and he called me an idiot and all sorts of stuff. So he fell out with me, and I don't know why, because it was just a silly mistake, and it wasn't anything offensive. But anyway, you got all these big guns, and Andrew Feinstein, as soon as he stood down from the top of your party organising something, everybody wanted to know what Andrew would say at the conference. So we've already got people following leaders yet again, and they're pretty negative about your party as well, and they're pretty negative about the future. So I don't know why people latch on. It's kind of frustrating, because it's as if the British public needs, and these aren't stupid people, it's as if the British public need to follow someone and need to look up to them, when they've got they're perfectly capable of sorting themselves out. And surely that's the idea of communism. How do we put across to people what communism is, with people like John Williams and Kevin Overton and all that? It's far too technical, and it goes off at far too much a tangent. How are we going to communicate that kind of thing to the public? That's all I'm going to say.
You want to answer that before I bring in Dinah?
No, let Dinah speak.
Okay, go ahead, Dinah.
Stuff about the monarchy, but the monarchy isn't just a sort of. It is a nasty, oppressive, privileged group. The monarchy and its, all the family members and the aristocratic hangers-on and stuff. But they're also very, very much entangled with capitalism, with their own, their own capitalist enterprises and stuff. So you can't get rid of one without the other. It all has to be got rid of together. Was I going to say something else? Yeah. Oh, Mark saying about people following leaders, and I think maybe that's part of the legacy of the monarchy, that we've got to have these descendants of thieving thugs, because that's what they are, descendants of thieving thugs, to look up to, and that's been entrenched in our psyches from earliest age, right from the start of the education system.
Yeah. Can I just come back on Kevin Overton? Because Kevin Overton is an SWP cadre, or ex-SWP cadre. And I know him, and I can appreciate some qualities of him, but I am critical. And he can behave in a bureaucratic and hack-like manner. I'm not going to call him a hack or a bureaucrat, because that's ad hominem. But he's got bad habits. And there are a lot of people in the left who've got bad habits. And they need to unlearn them, actually. And that's part of the value of a new party with a real mass membership, assuming this is what's going to happen. And I think it is. It's already got 50,000 members, which is actually the biggest split the Labour Party has ever had, right? It's bigger than the ILP was already. But that's, I think, you ain't seen nothing yet. That's my expression. That's my suspicion, right? But a mass party will have to clean out all the sectarian bad habits of the far left in this country, which is very bad. You know, I mean, the SWP are very bureaucratic. Yeah, actually, Kevin Overton was expelled from the SWP for his opposition to their attack on George Galloway in respect in about 2007, right? He and Rob Hovell were expelled from the SWP. They worked closely with Galloway in respect before Galloway went off to the right in his erratic way. Well, he was actually rather good most of the time. And they worked very closely with him. And when the SWP turned against Galloway, they refused to join in, and they got expelled from the SWP. So did Nick Rack, actually. So they've done some good things, but they've also got bad habits of, the hack training that the SWP cadre have. So they're going to have to unlearn things, you know. We're going to, you know, lots of people are going to have to unlearn things. We're going to have to learn things about how to work in a real mass party environment, you know. I mean, I've had some experience at it in the small way with things like respect, which is bigger than most things that people have been involved in, but this is much bigger still, you know. And well, you know, it's a learning curve for everybody, including people like Kevin Ovenden, and I think he might have some shocks in store. I wouldn't take him as a great authority on how a party should be run, because he's although he's done some good things, he's got the training of the bad cadre training of the SWP. So, that's my view anyway.
Yeah. If I may, I was going to come in on that. You talked about we need to get rid of bad habits. I've noticed that over the past few weeks, those of us on the left are all used to using terms like grassroots democracy, when I've come across an awful lot of organisations or individuals within organisations who talk about grassroots democracy, but when it comes down to it, they don't really believe in grassroots democracy. Just a buzzword for them. They want to get their group of people at the front and then claim it grassroots democracy. So I'm becoming increasingly sceptical of that term, grassroots democracy, because of some of the proponents of it. Sorry to be negative. I'll stop there, thanks.
Yeah, well, just one thing is that I'll come back if nobody else wants to speak. I'll just say that my attitude to the so-called ultra-democrats in the CP, in your party, are buzzing around, complaining all the time about how undemocratic things are. It's not clear to me that things are terribly undemocratic. I went to the regional aggregate, or the assembly, and though it wasn't in the sense of votes and we were not voting on policies, we had free discussion. We had a whole load of proposals put forward through a particular channel, which I don't know what will happen, but I think it's not a cynical exercise. It's a genuine attempt at some level at promoting political discussion and debate, but it's not at the level that some of the purists would like, you know. And some of these purist sectarian types, like the CPGB, are not so democratic as they think they are, because I've been in their organisation. I've been kicked out for dissenting views, or treated badly for dissenting views. And I'm sceptical about their democratic credentials, you know. I would not trust them as far as I can throw them, you know. So I think we should keep a critical distance, and I have. I mean, if you look at the motions that I did circulate these amendments, if you look at the amendments that I put forward, they're slightly different to what they're putting forward, in the sense of dual membership, and they just want, if it goes, you can do what you like, you know. I don't agree. I don't think people should be allowed to be joint members of the Labour Party and your party. I don't think people should be allowed to be joint members of the Green Party and your party. On the other hand, you should have full factional freedom, and there shouldn't be, you know, there shouldn't be a cancel culture in your party for people who, you know, with controversial views on some things. I mean, even the question of trans rights, it really needs to be debated. There are many people, I can think of several, who have what I can, you know, latently, not so much up front, but have positions that I don't agree with on trans rights, because I actually am strongly for for defending trans rights, but there are others who we work with today who probably not want the same views. But I think this needs to be debated in a rational manner, and it needs to be argued out with some people. But I think the party's position does very clearly need to be defending trans rights. You know, we need to find ways of debating some of these questions, because we're going to have some. Look, if we start to, if there's a division about Ukraine in the party, which there will be, it's going to get bloody heated. You know, we're going to have to fight. We had to fight this out in the Socialist Labour Network, and we won the debate eventually. But it was not easy, you know. And it will not be easy in your party. But I know that nobody in a senior position that I know of has got our position, you know. But you never know; it might change, you know, because of the change in the objective situation may well change people's minds, you know. The exposure of Zelensky's Nazi confreres. Yeah, all this stuff can change people's minds, you know. Just as the exposure of the genocide in Gaza has changed the minds of some people on Zionism, has made them a bit more stiff, a bit more prepared to stand up to it than they were, you know. So, you know, we are not sectarians. We don't write people off, you know. That's the point I'm making, really. How these questions... It's not the question of why you're firm on these questions or not. We are firmly in favour of trans rights. We are firmly in favour of defence of the special military operation in Ukraine. But how you actually debate this in a mass party when there are heterogeneous views on it is something we're going to have to go through a bit of a learning curve, I'm afraid. Yeah, I'll leave it there.
On the subject of trans rights, I would leave some comment over now. Years ago, I used to be a transphobe because of my own experience with one individual that I used to know years ago. But over the years, I'm actually now growing in favour of trans rights. I realised that my experience of one person doesn't give me the right to denigrate a whole community of people from that community. On the issue of trans rights, my own experience looking at people online, I kind of see on the anti-trans side, I think there's generally two groups. There are those that come at it from a point of ignorance, and they're not actually transphobic. They might come out with things, they might say things to the transphobic because they're coming at it from a point of ignorance. But there are also others that spend an awful lot of time and energy, you know, point blank. Well, they fear trans people, you know, and so they buy into all these stories of men dressed up as women waiting outside of public convenience, that kind of thing. So I have noticed that. Yeah. So not everyone who expresses an element of scepticism about trans rights is necessarily transphobic. It's just that they're at different stages of a learning curve, so to speak.
Yeah,
I have noticed that, but there are others out there that are blatantly transphobic, and some of us know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Mark A.
Cheers, Paul. Yeah, on a general point, but related to that, I wouldn't want to be a part of a socialist party that's sectarian, as you say, Ian.
Yeah, yeah.
But in terms of the wider population in the country, neither should we engage in identity politics with any section of the community. Everyone should be included and be treated on an equal basis, you know? I know that can be easier said than done. But that has to be a priority. However, if the way you present a particular subject smacks of preferential treatment, i.e. identity politics, then a lot of people are going to look upon that ahead of any infrastructural change that we want to make for the country. And they're going to think, oh, that's all they're, you know, that's all we can associate them with. We can't associate them with anything else because they support this particular group at the expense of any other wider policy, social policy. And that is a danger. And that can't be just swept aside. Thanks.
Ian?
Yeah, I'll come back briefly. I mean, we know people, we have good relationships with people that, you know, we've had bad experiences in our own organisation with people with transphobic views. And I'm thinking of Liz in particular in the past, you know. But we've got good collaboration with Esther Giles in the Socialist Labour Network, who has historically had transphobic views, but doesn't seem to attach a great deal of importance to them these days. And she works with us. I had a big argument with her about 3 years ago about trans, and it became very heated. But that was on Facebook, not in the context of the SLN, you know. At least I think it was on Facebook. I remember it distinctly, and it got quite heated, but it seems to have calmed down, and she's very happy to collaborate with us, despite our not only our pro-trans views, but also our supposedly nasty views on Zionism, which Tony has demonised, and I think for a while his arguments were beginning to have some impact on her, but I think she's now realised that he lies and lies and lies about things and demonises his opponents. But, I mean, it's complex, isn't it? I mean, there's all sorts of strands we have to get through. And there must be ways of debating these things rationally that can actually, you know, overcome divisions and hopefully lead to something better, you know. Even if people don't necessarily agree on every nuance, they might find themselves agree on most things and agreeing to work together, even when they don't strictly agree on some sensitive questions, you know. And if that's the case, then fine, you know.
Can I just add to this? Sorry, Paul, just a quick one. On that point, I don't agree with the Workers' Party's position, who do seem to be anti-trans.
Yeah, yeah.
Example. Right, shut up now, Karen.
On the issue of trans, well, not just with trans, but also potential other social issues, there is a problem of, I guess Mark A probably touched upon it, and the way there are people out there who especially in and around the Workers' Party, who seem to think these are social issues, therefore socialists don't deal with them, and these are economic issues, and these are the issues socialists deal with. But actually, if you take the issue of trans and the issue of the right to abortion and so on, they are class issues.
Yes.
They affect working class people in ways that they won't affect people with money, because people with money have resources at their disposal that ordinary working class people don't have. So they are class issues. They're intertwined. That's my view on it. Ian.
I just noticed that note from Diana about Elizabeth the First. Elizabeth the First? Is that who you mean? Lizzie the First.
Yeah, that's who I mean.
Elizabeth the First was intersex. Really, that's interesting. I never knew that.
Yeah, I don't know how. I don't know how they've done the DNA test. The claim is that she had XY chromosome, similar to that woman, call her a woman because she was identifying as a woman on YouTube. You came across one of the the Facebook groups, who was saying she had XY chromosomes, but testosterone or estrogen, which I'm a bit intrigued by, but never developed as a boy. So she had no characteristics of either male or female.
That's interesting.
But that would fit with the first Lizzie, because she had characteristics. There's historical records that are reliable about that. Had characteristics that are compatible with the XY chromosome, which never develops into a male.
Mm-hmm.
Never married, never had sex with anybody. Couldn't have children, couldn't produce an heir.
Right.
So, and her body was a total mess by the time she died, but that wasn't because she was intersex. That was a stupid life she led.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mark C. and then Susan.
I think going back to what Diane was saying about the monarchy earlier, it's so funny that this is me laughing at the irony, not the things that have gone on, but it's so funny that the King of England has denounced his brother when the King of England was best mates with Jimmy Savile. His father was best mates with Jimmy Savile, and you can go off on jaunts. I think Mountbatten, I don't know whether Mountbatten was connected with Savile, I think he was. Just about everybody in the royal family throughout history has been scum, behaved like scum in some way or another. So anything that the royal family do, especially at the moment, denouncing Andrew, is just like it's to save their own backs and make themselves look good. That's all they've spent their time doing. And meanwhile, they're getting our money for doing it, which is so frustrating. And people still refuse to see through it. So it's like some politicians are so obviously, like Trump, narcissistic sociopaths or narcissists, and people either don't see it or refuse to accept that it is.
Mm-hmm.
It's just unbelief. I don't know. I just don't know. Anyway, that's what I was going to say.
Susan.
Yes, I've seen several YouTube videos claiming that Elizabeth I's tomb was opened, and that they have done some genetic tests on it. The royals tend to be very precious about who can and can't investigate. So I'm still looking for some scientific papers that will put it. But I agree with you. TTF or testicular feminization syndrome, yeah, XY females would certainly fit with a lot of her things. But I think that what disappoints me most is that the arguments for ensuring human rights for intersex are less championed than those people who feel that they wish to change their sex, because not because of their chromosomal anomalies of any sort, but because they feel that they are not within the right body. And we have to protect people from this business of, because of their lifetime experiences, often sexual abuse or other abuses of mental or physical abuse, that some people retreat into changing sex as their only option to deal with unbearable pain and experiences.
Mm.
And it's about nurturing human rights for everybody that treat people with tolerance and understanding, but not going down the everyone must be safe. And where I fell out with people this morning on the Crispin show was that people were talking about, oh, Zara's terrible. She wants children of 14 to be able to join, at which point I was really cross because the Labour Party's always had a membership from 14. And I don't want to see children excluded from having a political life experience or education by actually joining parties and learning how to debate and how to understand and grow within a system that they find friendly. So, you know, we've got to get away from this. You can only be safe if you have, you know, if you're surrounded by people you identify with. You know, we can't engage if we are not prepared to, you know, to accept that there will be, shall we say, uncomfortable experiences, and that that is part and parcel of young people's education too. You know, that they will have to learn to defend their own ideas and to understand and find where, you know, where they feel they are on the political spectrum as much as anywhere else. You know, it can't all be taught in school, or it can't all be taught by parents, can it?
Do you want to come back on any of that?
No.
I'd like an answer on the what you feel about the 14-year-old or the rejection of it, Ian.
Well, I'll quickly come in on that then, because I agree with you. I think it's, my God, it's a rule in the Labour Party. Why should it be any different in here? It's a basic, you know, she wants a youth group as well, you know, as I understand it. And a youth group would be a very good idea, yeah.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm not opposed to what you're saying, actually.
Diana.
I agree with Ian and Susan about the inclusion of 14-year-olds and having a youth group. Susan's comments about intersex, that's something which just never gets mentioned. I've seen heated discussions and disagreements with people discussing trans. But what really, you know, you say, everybody's born either male or female. No, they are not.
Yeah.
That is an absolute lie. And our society rejects those people. They reject those people more than they reject trans people. But one thing, and we really do need those people to be recognised, catered for, and helped to proceed in life in the way that they choose to, whether they choose to say, no, I'm not male or female, or choose to be one or the other. And they should be supported in that.
Mm.
One thing that I am curious about, because like, I really can't understand why somebody would want to go through the horrors of transitioning from one sex to another, because of the intrusive surgery and hormones and stuff. But one thing I am curious about is how many trans people are actually intersex, and they're not so much transitioning as assigning a sex. I'd be fascinated to know that.
Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer to that one. I'm afraid I'm not sure what the proportions really are. Someone else might know, but I don't know. I'm not sure. I know it's a very small minority of trans people, but I'm not sure exactly what the proportions are, to be honest.
That was effectively the point that I don't know what the woman ruling over, but when there was that Supreme Court ruling about who could use what toilets and so on, the artist Colter Ray, she's intersex, but the point you were making would a system for her to be assigned a sex at birth. So Diana's onto something there when how many people might be transitioning because society basically forced them to conform to a particular gender, which, that after she was saying, I think he's saying that on the chromosomal level, she was male, but she has a womb, doesn't produce any, she doesn't have any testes and doesn't have any ovaries. So, so it then becomes a question, what space am I allowed in? Either both the spaces or neither of them. And so that's where I felt the court ruling was a big step backwards in more ways than I actually realised at the time. It was putting people in danger that weren't necessarily in danger publicised, Ian.
I'm not going to come back now.
Come back on any of those points.
I'm not
earlier.
Really. I think that's it. This all sounds like valid stuff to me. Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Yeah, we can now.
Right. I think my connection was a little bit wobbly for a second. But yeah, I agree with pretty much what you're saying. It's all, you know, it's complex, isn't it? You know. Shall we wind up? Because I think it's getting close to 6 o'clock, to be honest. And is there any other points? Well, I could sum up, but I think it's been a good discussion.
Stop the recording.
It's been a good discussion, I think. It's been quite wide-ranging, which is fine. You know, I mean, we're talking about how we operate in this new environment, really. I think there's going to be a lot of complex tactical questions, but it's good to actually get talking about the strategic question of the state. And I think we've broached on that, but there's a lot more to delve into in this book, you know, because that's just a brief introductory chapter. And there is stuff that takes up the Paris Commune and all sorts of stuff, you know, in more detail, which we'll come on to in... we'll have a little meeting in 2 weeks' time and discuss another chapter, if that's possible. And I just wonder if, Paul, you wanted to have a go at that, yeah? Perhaps?
Thing is, I haven't read chapter 2 yet. I found this one pretty tough going. To actually read it. Doing presentation on it, I'm not confident yet.
Well, maybe I'll do it, but you can start reading chapter 3, yeah? If you can read
that might be a better way.
If you can, read chapters 2 and 3, I will start doing a chapter 2 presentation. I think it'll be much more. This was an introductory presentation, and it did try to put it in the political context that we've got to discuss this in, which is why I talked about the genesis of neoliberalism and the decline of social democracy at some length. You know. Because that's the context we're in, you know, as well as the actual points in the chapter, which are not too long, they're not too complex. I think I summed them up fairly well, but we can go on to the more detailed stuff and delve into it more. And I think we've set the context now, so we can delve into it in more depth next time. Yeah. Is that all right, comrades?
Yeah.
Should I turn the recording off then, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, let me just do that.